As I said earlier, this week is Thanksgiving, and it's a special time, you know, as far as for all of us as Americans, as I said, and we tend to, hopefully we take the time to be thankful and think about the things that God has bestowed upon us and blessed us with, instead of just using it as a day for extreme caloric intake and football watching. So I know that's what it was when I first, you know, as a young man, not in the church. It was basically a day of gluttony and football. So we've moved beyond that. And there are some significant things about the day of Thanksgiving that it's good to think about as it comes upon us. My wife received something in the mail from Linda Brewer that is entitled Serving Up a Few Chuckles. And it says, "Sir, it's stressed out over having company, cooking a perfect turkey, and making sure everyone at the table gets his or her favorite side dish. Laughter, as they say, is the best medicine, as you know, misery loves company." So here are a few things that have come over the Butterball turkey talk line. So interestingly, Butterball has a line that you can call, I guess, in desperation on Thanksgiving Day to express whatever's going wrong with your turkey preparation. And it one of these says, one cook called in to ask how long it would take to roast her turkey. The talk line's home economist asked how much the bird weighed. But the woman didn't know yet. Turns out the turkey was still very much alive and running around outside in the woman's yard. So it may take a while to catch it, do all the things to prepare it. The guest list for one California family's dinner included a vegetarian. The hostess called to ask how to prepare a turkey so the vegetarian could eat it. So I'm sure it's interesting taking these calls. And then everyone at one West Coast woman's table preferred white meat over dark. So the cook used bleach to turn the dark pieces white. When she called in to find out how to clean off the bleach, she was, of course, advised to throw the ruined bird away. So hopefully we don't bleach our turkey in order to make sure we have all white meat for the crowd that's at our house. I know I remember watching an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond, and the wife of the family there was trying to ensure that everybody was eating healthier. So instead of having regular turkey, they were having tofurkey. And I'm just, and I could just admit, and these guys are kind of taking a bite of it and pounding on the table like when you're trying to get something down that you don't like. And I could just relate to that. Boy, if we had tofurkey, how bad it would be. But anyway, I prefer the regular turkey, and we always do have some good turkey and good things to go along with it. But as you look at the time that we're in, the Feast of Tabernacles is over and the last great day, so God's holy day season has come to a close. And as that season comes to a close, we begin a period of time in which it seems like we have one pagan festival after another. Behind us is Halloween, and ahead of us is Christmas, the big one. It is the big one. The push for Christmas sales are already underway. You have endless commercials on TV, and you receive flyers in the mail and advertisements telling you about the sale at this store and that store. I know that, as I think I've mentioned in the past, they had to have spent an entire week, maybe 6 or 7 days, with about 8 to 10 people working on this huge Christmas display of things that they're selling for Christmas. This whole team of people was dedicated to that and had to set them all up. And, you know, you have crowds at every mall, you have Christmas parties, Christmas music, and you're going to be hearing everybody tell you Merry Christmas. And I was standing at work thinking about this. I'm working retail. I'm going to be besieged by that this year, which I've not been before. You know, in my office at home, nobody really brought up Christmas. But now that I work in retail, everybody's going to bring it up. So what am I going to reply when every customer almost that I face is going to say Merry Christmas? You know, I could say Bah Humbug as Ebenezer Scrooge, but that wouldn't be appropriate. So I've got to come up with something to respond, or possibly not respond at all. So anyway, they may just think that I'm rude. But anyway, it's something that you have to face. And during this time, you're also going to have conflicts over nativity scene displays and campaigns to keep Christ in Christmas. And, you know, as you look at it, you know, we all realize that as Christians, we don't keep it. And if we do keep it, are we actually honoring Christ? Then we move on at the end of the year to New Year's Eve. And New Year's Eve was a pagan festival. And yet, you know, you have people that will put on the party hats and drink the champagne and welcome in the new year. Is that something that we should be doing? Now, we would get together on that evening, not as a New Year's party, but we might play cards or we might play games or whatever, because we don't have to go to work the next day and people were off and it was a time to get together. You go on in the year and you come to Valentine's Day. What's wrong with hearts and sweethearts and candy? St. Patrick's Day. Wasn't St. Patrick a great saint? What's wrong with raising a glass of green beer in his honor? And then you get to Easter. Shouldn't we honor Christ's resurrection with Easter bonnets and Easter eggs and bunnies and baskets? I don't think we have bonnets anymore, but that's a thing of the past. But something that many people do. But we don't participate in those things. And typically when we discuss these issues, we turn to a passage in Scripture in Deuteronomy chapter 12. And let's turn there. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And let's begin in verse 29. Speaking to the nation of Israel here, and it's not just speaking to the nation of Israel, the physical people that were alive at the time when Moses brought this point up, but it's something that's important to all of us living in the here and now, because we are the Israel of God, and what he's saying here still applies. It says, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to possess, and you displace them and dwell in their land. So you're going to come into the land of Canaan, and in coming into the land of Canaan, they're going to be removed from the land. But they've had certain religious practices that you're not to continue. You're not to adopt, he's saying. He says here in verse 30, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. You're not to look to other practices, other religious practices found outside the Bible for how you worship God. God defines how you worship Him. It says, for every abomination to the Lord which He hates, they have done to their gods, for they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. You know, they have gone so far afield that they feel it is perfectly acceptable to burn a child in the fire in honor of their God. In verse 32 it says, whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. Now as you look at these verses, we commonly quote them. We're probably quite familiar with them if we've been around the church for a while. But did you know that Deuteronomy 12 has a lot more in it than just these four verses? There's more to it than just these four verses. As you go through Deuteronomy chapter 12, one of the things that you find in the chapter is God's designation of a place for worship. And we'll see as we go through the sermon today, the way Israel was to worship was even more important than was the place of worship. And seeing the full picture of this chapter only reinforces the last four verses that we've just taken a look at. So God introduced something to Israel that could have helped them avoid many of the problems and the troubles that they had as they drew away from God and worshiped the Baals and went into false religion. So let's see what it says here in this chapter. And let's begin going one verse above the four verses that we read to verse 28. There Moses says to the congregation of Israel, observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God." So he's telling them that it's important that you observe what I tell you to do. And there will be blessings that come from observing what I tell you to do. He's saying, if you honor me and you do what I tell you to do, then it will go well with you. So let's go back to a little earlier in the chapter to get the context here, and something that Mr. Radcliffe told us to do here. And so let's go back up to the last part of Deuteronomy chapter 11. Let's begin in verse 31. So it says here in verse 31, "For you will cross over the Jordan." So here Israel has come out of the land of Egypt. They've wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. That 40-year period is almost up, and they're on the banks, the eastern bank of the Jordan River, ready to enter the land. So the whole throng of Israelites is there, approximately 2 million people ready to enter the land. And so you will cross over the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and you will possess it and dwell in it. So God is giving them the land. They're going to cross the Jordan and enter into the land. And you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. So, as I said, you have these millions of Israelites there ready to cross over. They're getting everything in order. They're receiving their final instructions. And you can see probably if you were standing on the western side of the Jordan looking across, you would see thousands of tents, thousands of people. You could probably hear the donkeys making the sounds, the braying of the donkeys. You could probably hear the camels making the sounds that they make, and oxen lowing, and all of the sounds that would come from a camp of this size. See the smoke rising from the fires, and you would see all these people there on the edge of the land of Canaan. Now, Moses was holding a series of lectures for the leadership. It seems doubtful that you could get together 2 million people and his voice would be heard and they would hear everything he had to say. So probably he was speaking to the leadership so they could pass along the message to those over whom they had a responsibility. He was preparing them for conquering and keeping the land. And what he's telling them here, the main message he's getting across to them is, be careful to follow the instructions that you receive. I'm going to give you instructions about conquering the land. And as you think about it, what land are we to conquer? How does this apply to you and me? We don't have a land, we're not on the brink of the Jordan ready to conquer a land. But if you think about it, we've already crossed the Jordan. Jordan is a type of baptism. We've already crossed the Jordan and we have a responsibility to conquer the land. The land that we're to conquer is ourselves. We're to conquer sin in our own lives. So they're getting ready to conquer a physical land. We have to conquer our land spiritually and overcome sin. And so he's giving them a theme that should guide their conquest and our conquest, which is, be careful to follow the instructions you receive. So it's a clear theme in this particular chapter, and really it's a theme that's found throughout the entire book of Deuteronomy. So let's see what he says in verse 1, chapter 12, verse 1. It says in verse 1, "These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your God of your fathers is giving you to possess, all the days that you live on the earth." So I've given you commandments, I've given you statutes, I've given you judgments that you are to follow. And if you follow them, I will bless you and bring you great benefits, physical benefits for the people of Israel back in the time of Moses, but spiritual benefits for all of us. So we might assume that the entire nation time that, the second generation of Israelites wandered the wilderness, having the tabernacle and the sacrifices and the instructions that God had given, that they worshiped God faithfully. We know that the first generation that came out of Egypt did not do so, and they died in the wilderness. So by the time that they've come to the brink of entering the land of Canaan, the first generation is dead. And all that remains is the new generation, the second generation, plus Caleb, Joshua, and Moses at this point is still alive. And Moses is going to die before they actually cross into the land. So the second generation, as you think about the second generation, surely they had learned some lessons from their parents' failure. And surely they were more careful to worship God as he said they should. Right? Unfortunately, that's not true. And how do we know that? Let's go down to verse 8 of chapter 12. Chapter 8 of verse 12. God here tells them through Moses, "You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes." They were doing what was right in their own eyes, as far as worshiping God, as far as the practices that they held to. They were all doing what was right in their own eyes. And we live in a time that I think, in and out of the church, people tend to do pretty much what is right in their own eyes, as opposed to saying, hey, this is how it has to be, whether I like it or not. And that's a very dangerous position to be in, doing what is right in your own eyes. As you think about this, how could they have gotten into this attitude or mindset of doing what was right in their own eyes? Well, especially when it comes to the worship of God. Barnes notes on the Old Testament makes an interesting conclusion about their condition. It says, Moses points out that heretofore they had not observed the prescribed order in their worship. So God had a certain approach that he wanted them to have in worship, and they had not followed that. You'll notice that as they enter the land, they weren't circumcised. The first thing, they're there almost at Passover time, and for them to keep the Passover, they had to be circumcised. And that had to be done before the Passover, that particular year they entered into the land. So it says, because during their migratory life in the wilderness, it had been impossible to do so. During their wanderings, there were doubtless times when the tabernacle was not set up for days together, and when the daily sacrifice, together with many other ordinances, were necessarily omitted. Because they were migratory, they couldn't set up the tabernacle and carry out the sacrifices and the functions that would be a normal part of their life as God's people. This consideration must be carefully borne in mind throughout Deuteronomy. It illustrates the necessity for a repetition of very much of what was given at Mount Sinai, because it had not been rehearsed in their minds, and they had not been keeping it on an ongoing basis, and so some of that had slipped from their minds. And suggest the reason, go back to the quote, and suggest that the reason why some parts are so urgently reiterated and impressed, while others are left unnoticed, Moses now warns the people that as they were about to quit their unsettled mode of life, God's purpose of choosing for himself a place to set his name there would be executed. And God's purpose in setting up a place for them to establish the tabernacle and to establish a settled pattern of worship was to bring organization and repetition to their practices in order that they would rightly worship God. Now, this brings us to another clear theme found here in chapter 12, and that concerns the place of worship. And is it a big deal? Does God care? Let's take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 9 through 11. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 9 through 11. It says, "For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you." You've been a slave in Egypt, and you've been wandering in the wilderness, and you've not entered the rest yet. But now when you cross the Jordan and you go into Canaan, then you're going to enter the rest, which was a type of what the Sabbath represents to us, the rest. and the inheritance. But when you cross over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place that, where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord. So it's going to be done in an organized fashion, brought to a central location for the centralized worship of God. And this is going to be of benefit to a physical people whom God was dealing with at the time. It says, in going on here in verse 12, or in verse 11, it says, there you will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name, and you're to bring all of this there. Now, indeed, the place is mentioned in a number of different locations here in the chapter, in verses 5 through 7. It says, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God. And you shall rejoice in all to which you have put your hands, you and your households in which the Lord your God has blessed you. So God keeps repeating this. And this isn't the only time that he makes this point. Go down to verse 11. It tells us that you shall go there. And then in verse 12 it says, and you shall rejoice before the Lord, you and your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion nor inheritance with you. Verse 14, he says, but in the place which the Lord chooses. And he keeps repeating this, repeating it again in verse 18 and verse 21 and verse 26. In fact, this theme of the place is mentioned 9 times in the 32 verses of this chapter. So obviously, this is a big point with God. He has a reason for establishing this place in order to have an organized approach to the worship of God. So God designated a place for worship which was unique in the entire world. Now, what place did God choose to establish this place of worship? Jerusalem? Jerusalem, was that the location where he set up the tabernacle? That's what we might think, but the first place that God established the tabernacle was in a place called Gilgal. It was first established in Gilgal. That's the place where the Israelites were circumcised and was their base of operations when they first entered into the land of Canaan. As things became more settled, the tabernacle was moved to a location within the tribe of Ephraim, the territory of the tribe of Ephraim, which was called Shiloh. So they moved the tabernacle to Shiloh, and the tabernacle remained at Shiloh until the time of Eli, when the people of Israel were defeated in battle by the Philistines at the Battle of Ebenezer, and then they captured the Ark of the Covenant, and they destroyed the site at Shiloh. And they held on to the tabernacle. It was eventually returned to the people of Israel. And it was not until the time of David when the tabernacle eventually was moved back to Jerusalem, after David had conquered the city of Jerusalem and set that up. So, interestingly, as you think about Jerusalem, let's go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 6. It wasn't until nearly 500 years later, after Israel had entered the land, that that God chose Jerusalem. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 6. So David had conquered the city of Jerusalem, taken it from the Canaanites, and had established his city there. It's called the City of David. And chapter 6, verse 5. It says, since the day that I brought my people out of the land of Egypt, I have chosen no city from any tribe of Israel in which to build a house. So this wasn't just setting up the tabernacle, but to build a house. That my name might be there, nor did I choose any man to be ruler over my people Israel. Yet I have chosen Jerusalem, that my name may be there, and that I have chosen David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a temple for the name of the Lord God of Israel. So God eventually said, I'm going to have my house built. You know, David wanted to build a house for God, and God inspired him to build that house. And David spent much of his life accumulating all of the things that would be necessary for that building. He accumulated it all, but God would not allow him to build the temple of God. He left it to David's son. And let's go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. David's son went on to build that house there in Jerusalem. It was a magnificent place, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Chapter 7, verse 12. It says, then the Lord appeared to Solomon. So as the dedication of the temple is being made, the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among the people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. So God is going to establish his fixed dwelling place among the people of Israel in Jerusalem, in the temple, in the Holy of Holies. And God heard Solomon's prayer. And he's telling them, you know, how this was all going to work. And obviously God recognized that Israel would not always be faithful, that they would get away from the true faith. But as they would repent and turn to him, then they could come before him and they could be forgiven and their relationship could be established. He would, as he says, I will forgive their sin and heal their land. Verse 15, now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. For now I have chosen and sanctified this house, that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. So God was to dwell in that place. It was to be a place into which they could bring their offerings and they could bring their tithes and those kinds of things to God, and God would hear their prayers and God would forgive them and heal their land. So God sanctified the house Solomon built for him, and from then on the temple became a most important place for the nation of Israel, and it remained a focal point for the nation of Judah even after the northern tribes departed from God. And the Jerusalem temple was the center of the faithful Israelites' religion. And it remained so from all the way down to the time of Jesus Christ. But as one of the things that took place with the nation of Israel is they were not, it wasn't for a very long time that they were a united kingdom. They were a united kingdom under David, they were under Saul, under David, and they were a united kingdom under Solomon. And even in David's time, they were not completely united. David ruled over Judah. And then eventually the people of the northern kingdom said, hey, we would like you to be our king. And then he ruled over one nation. And Solomon ruled over one nation, but with his son assuming the throne and the way that he treated the people, then there was a separation between the people of the northern tribes and the southern tribes. And there were two nations then. The northern kingdom was ruled by a man named Jeroboam, and what Jeroboam saw was the temple is the central place of worship for the people of Israel. And for me to allow those people over whom I rule to go down to the festivals and at the appropriate times of the year and to go to the temple, they're going to come to long for our being one nation again, and I'm not going to give up my power. So he made a political calculation. How do I maintain my power? Well, what do? I will build a place of worship within my territory. And I will build that up, and I will establish my own priest, not priest from the line of Levi, but from priests that have an allegiance to me. They're political appointees who will carry out the religious functions. And what did he do? He adopted the ways of the Egyptians and the worship system that they established. He established calves in Dan and in Samaria. So calves were central to their worship. And he also established, he took from the Canaanite shrines on the high places. They were all part of the worship system he developed, and it became a snare to the people of Israel. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 12. So Jeroboam was wise in a worldly sense, because he could see, if I don't take this action, then I may not be king for long. And I most assuredly may not be able to establish a dynasty. So I want to make sure my kingdom goes on. So let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 25. It says, "Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, 'Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah.' Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, 'It is too much. I'm just looking out for you.'" When you hear politicians tell you that, you better look out. So he said, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he built up one in Bethel, not in Samaria, but in Bethel, as I was incorrect in saying Samaria. And the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin for the people, went to worship before the one as far as Dan. So it says he made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam not only set up these shrines, but it says Jeroboam ordained a feast. He ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month. There was no feast of God on the 15th day of the 8th month. He made it like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar, so he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made, and at Bethel he installed the priest of the high places which he had made. So, weren't they honoring God? That's what he told them. So there was no problem with this, was there? As long as you're honoring God, it really doesn't matter what you do, does it? And this is the system that he set up. Let's go to chapter 13, chapter 13, verse 33. Chapter 13, verse 33. It says here, "After this event, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil way." Jeroboam never repented of what he had done and the damage that he did to the tribes under his rule. He did not turn from his evil way, but again he made priests from every class of people for the high places. Whoever wished, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places. And this thing was the sin of the house of Jeroboam, so as to exterminate and destroy it from the face of the earth. God didn't take it lightly. He said, "I'm going to destroy your house." And he did great damage to the people of Israel. The corruption was lasting and led to the severing the vast majority of the northern tribes from God. They lost sight of the true worship of God. The northern tribes forsook the place that God had established. And this action subsequently contributed to their losing sight of God and their identity as the people of God. Now the southern kingdom held on for a little while longer, but sometimes they did well, sometimes they didn't do well. And eventually they didn't do well, and they were carried into captivity as well. As you go down in the time of their history, you go down to the time of Hezekiah, who is actually a righteous king. He was a righteous king and helped to establish a revival in the land of Israel. And as we look at what we're going to talk about here, the son of Hezekiah, who is Manasseh, it's amazing. You can have a righteous king, and yet the king that follows him, who's been taught the truths of God, can reject God completely, as did Manasseh. And what happened with Manasseh relates to, you know, whatever pagan holiday you want to put in the blank. Let's go to 2 Kings 21. 2 Kings 21, you're moving toward the end of the kingdom of Judah. Israel has already gone into captivity. And Manasseh greatly overstepped the bounds here. 2 Kings chapter 21, let's begin in verse 1. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places. His father had gone through the process of removing all the high places, and he restored them. As it says, which Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. He raised up altars for Baal and made a wooden image, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. And he worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem, I will put my name. He desecrated the house of God. And he said, and he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of God. Also, he made his son pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, and consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will not make the feet of Israel wander anymore from Israel, which I gave their fathers, only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. We've looked at Deuteronomy at the commands that Moses was giving them. But they paid no attention, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. So Manasseh did great damage to the people of Israel and led them astray. And they had a choice, but they willingly followed Manasseh in the wrong direction. And from God's perspective, this was the last straw. And God made the decision to pull back from the temple. Let's look at verse 10. And the Lord spoke by his servants, the prophets, saying, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominable abominations, he has acted more wickedly than all the Amorites who were before him. And he has made Judah sin with his idols. Therefore, says the Lord of God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such calamity upon Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle. What's coming is going to be a terrible thing. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab, and I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. So I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies, and they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies, because they have done evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. Now Manasseh came to repentance, and so God did not carry out his warning here in Manasseh's time. But it did come. In fact, Israel was to go on and have another righteous king who cleansed things, Josiah. But he did the cleansing, and Israel turned back to God for a while, but that did not last. So we're not going to rehearse the entire history of the temple except to note that God didn't pull his presence, as I said, for a little while longer. And Israel had vacillated between doing what was right and not throughout their history. And sometimes they were faithful, sometimes they were corrupt. As you look at them after the second temple had been built in the time of Jesus Christ, you find that the people, you know, the religious leaders at that time had become corrupt, politicized. They were dishonest and spiritually bankrupt. But even in that time, what did Jesus say about the temple? He said, "It is my Father's house. It is my Father's house." And as we think about this, let's go to a critical scripture in John, in which a woman of Christ's day summarized how the Jews had come to regard the temple. Let's go to John chapter 4, verse 20. John chapter 4, verse 20. John chapter 4, verse 20. The woman here, Christ and his disciples were traveling through Samaria, and they came upon the Samaritan woman, and they entered into a conversation here. And there was always a conflict between the Samaritans and the Jews. You see it in the parable of the Good Samaritan. There was a conflict, and the Jews looked down on the Samaritans, and they did not get along because they had set up what the Jews felt was a false system of worship to their north, which in fact they had done. But verse 20 says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." So the Samaritan said it's on the mountain where Christ was, and the Jews said it was in fact in Jerusalem. So the Samaritans had a temple on Mount Gerizim, which was quite similar to the one the Jews had in Jerusalem. And this was the continuing, you know, in one sense, it was a continuing consequence of Jeroboam's establishment of an alternate place. Because, yes, the tribes of Israel had been carried into captivity, but the Samaritans had been moved in, and they established their own system of worship. The Samaritans made a strong argument for their place. They reasoned that this was the mountain on which Moses told Israel to build an altar, engraving on it the Ten Commandments. Now, if you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 27, it tells the story of the time when Israel would first cross the Jordan. And the scriptures there tell us that it was Mount Ebal, but not Mount Gerizim, but the Samaritans argued that it was Mount Gerizim, saying that just because Deuteronomy 27 says it's Mount Gerizim, that's a mistranslation. So even back in that time, there were conflicts over what was true in the Bible and whether there were mistranslations and all of that. Arguments over the accuracy of translations were going on even at that time. But you know, as you look at that, at this particular point, neither the Samaritans nor the Jews got it completely right. They didn't get it right. True worship wasn't about the temple. True worship wasn't about the temple. It wasn't about the place. It wasn't about the place. Even though we've looked at the place being a most important thing, the place isn't the most important thing. It never was about where you worship. And Jesus is making that point here. It was who we worship, and it is how we worship Him that's important. It's who we worship and how we worship, not the place. For instance, this building is a nice building, but it has no religious significance other than that we, God's people, meet here. And the place doesn't matter. But it's who we worship and how we worship. And Christ makes that point in verse 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." So if the place is important, how could that be? It's because the place isn't important, is not the most significant issue. So he added this vital point, which actually restates one of the themes that Moses gave Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 12. He goes on to say in verse 22, "You worship what you do not know. We know that we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." The salvation is to come through the Jews, through the Messiah. And the Jews were the ones who preserved the Word of God. "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him." See, God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. When you worship God in spirit, that means you don't need a location to worship Him. You don't need an image to worship Him. You don't need it. Because when you take something from the created realm and you take that and you put it up before people, you have limited God by that very action. So if you have a picture of Jesus, if you have something up on the wall of Jesus or God or whatever it may be, you have limited God. And God said, you don't need any of that. You know that I exist, and you diligently seek me and worship me. Is he formed and shaped as a human being? Sure he is. But we don't know what he looks like. We don't know what he looks like, and it's not important what he looks like. So we must worship God in spirit and in truth. Truth and doctrinal accuracy in worship is all important to God. What is the truth? God tells us how we should worship him. Now, as you think about, but what are the place, you know, we've talked about the place, what are the place of which Moses spoke and that we trace through the centuries? It seems so important as we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 12. Yet Christ established the church of God alongside the system of temple worship. You see, the church was founded in 31 A.D., and temple worship continued from 31 A.D. until the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D. It continued. And many Christians who lived in Jerusalem did continue to worship at the temple. But what about those churches that were established throughout the Roman Empire? You know, the church in Antioch and the church in Cyprus and the church, you know, on the island of Cyprus, the churches in Asia Minor. They had to learn that I don't have to go up to the temple to worship God. And the Jews were going to have to learn that as well. The temple, as I said, so the book, you know, as you look at the book of Hebrews, it gently but clearly showed the church of God was no longer working through the physical temple. And this was quite, and you know, as Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, it was quite likely a controversial book, given the scriptures from Deuteronomy forward about the place where God was going to establish his name. But look at what it says. It says in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, it says, "Christ is the minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle in heaven." You see, the earthly tabernacle and the earthly temple was just a type of what was in heaven. And Christ serves as the high priest. The Levitical priesthood and all the Levites were out of a job because they were no longer necessary, because we have one high priest today, and that is Jesus Christ, who represents us at God's right hand. It says in Hebrews 9:11, "Christ came with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands." The heavenly tabernacle. Further, we're told in Hebrews 11, verse 16, it tells us that there was a city that was prepared for the faithful, and it was not an earthly Jerusalem. And let's look at Hebrews chapter 13, verse 14. So the book of Hebrews, the fundamental point was to tell the Jews that Jerusalem was no longer the focal point of God's work with the establishment of the church. And you no longer had priests who were going to make sacrifices for you. You now had a high priest after the order of Melchizedek who would represent us before the throne of God. He is our mediator. He is the only mediator. And Hebrews chapter 13, verse 14. It says, "For we have no continuing city. We have no continuing city. There is no city that we look to here on earth. But we seek the one to come." We seek the one to come. We seek that heavenly Jerusalem. And we look forward to that unending spiritual legacy with Jerusalem. So this place, special though it was to be a means to an end. The heart of Moses' instruction to the Israelites wasn't setting apart a place of worship, but rather that the Israelites were to be set apart through their worship. You see, by being a Christian and the way that you worship God, you are different than the world. You are different than the world. And because the way that you approach God is different. So let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, and let's look at verse 2. Deuteronomy chapter 12, and it tells Israel what they're to do. It says here in verse 2, "You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and every green tree. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire, and you shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things." So he said, you're to make a change. You're not to worship as the nations around you worship. You're not to worship as the people of the land. And the people around us have a certain form of worship, and we're not to be involved with it. And we are to rid our lives of it. And I know that, the last time I kept, Christmas was in 1971. My last Christmas, I'm not sure, I was thinking about it, did I know that I shouldn't keep Christmas, or was I just figuring that out? I think at the time I felt I was in so deep at that point I'd better go ahead and finish it out and then move on and begin in 72 not to keep Christmas. So it was a radical change because, I grew up with, sugar plums dancing around in my head and anxiously awaiting Santa to arrive and bring all the gifts. I did all of those things. But, God says you got to leave all of that behind. And that's what God instructs us to do. The Roman Catholic Church made it a practice to incorporate some of the customs of those people who held to these particular religious practices because they wanted to convert the people they were teaching. And so what they did is they said, you know what, it's better that they're in the church and we allow them to keep some of their practices than to say you have to do away with that. Because they knew their church wasn't going to grow if they were to enforce, you can't do these things. So if they worship the sun, the priest or missionaries encouraged them to continue doing so, but they would tell them about the Son of God. If they included a day for the dead in their worship, the missionaries encouraged them to keep on, but to think of immortal souls in hell or in heaven. And the result was that the Catholic Church spread its view of Christianity throughout Europe, the British Isles, Mexico, Latin America, and all around the world. And the customs people kept were something of a potluck mixture of pagan religion and the faith of the Bible. They're a mixture. And God said you can't mix it. So, but from the beginning of establishing a place of worship, God said his people must have nothing to do with false religion and false worship. Yet the place isn't what set apart the people. What set them apart? Let's go to John chapter 17, verse 17. And we'll look at a word that relates to something Mr. Radcliffe brought out. John 17, verse 17. A short, simple verse that's well worth remembering. John chapter 17, verse 17. John 17, verse 17. It says, "Sanctify them by your truth." That was Christ's prayer for those who followed him. Sanctify them by your truth. What sanctifies us? Our place of worship? Or the truth? The truth sets you apart. The truth is what makes you different. Your word is truth. You see, you know, as you, all of you in the workplace now, you've had to deal with this every year. You have to deal with the Christmas party. You have to deal with all the people saying Merry Christmas. You have to deal with all that. And you have to deal with it every year. And when you do not go along with it, how do they look on you? Some of them think you're nuts. Some of them think you're, you know, what's wrong with you? And, and some people are tolerant, some people are less tolerant. But it's something that we all have to deal with because we have been sanctified by the truth. What is the truth? Because it guides our conduct, it guides our worship. And where do we find the truth? It's in the Bible. It says, "Your word is truth." So what does the Bible tell us about it? So why does the United Church of God not participate in, you fill in the holiday? It comes down to the simple but inviolable matter of truth. We follow the way of life God has revealed to Israel through Moses, a theme that continues throughout the Bible to the time of Christ who added to it. It is the way of being set apart from the religions of the land. It is the way of worshiping God, as he said, to worship him in spirit and in truth. So as you think about those verses at the end of Deuteronomy, which are still applicable, remember that it says we are not to adopt those ways. And there's much more to the story, as we've seen, than just those four verses. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a better understanding of why we do what we do.